Hello, good morning and welcome. My name is Graham and I'm delighted to be with you all today as we start these journeys into asking what it is to be really free. Free from constraints and conformity, free from constant testing and peer pressure, and free from unsafe and uninspiring school environments. Free to let children explore the world around them through play, cooperation and inspiration. Free to let children learn naturally, following their innate curiosity and endless creativity.
We come to see that learning isn't about doing well at school. It's about engaging with life.
I'll be here for you, and I will serve you, and I will carry your message around.
Today's guest is a gentleman whose name comes up in most conversations about alternatives to school. Through his scientific research into how children learn, predominantly through play and cooperation. Today we are talking to the esteemed Dr. Peter Gray. Dr. Gray is a research professor at Boston College and author of the must-read, highly recommended, Free to Learn. He has conducted and published research in comparative, evolutionary, developmental and educational psychology. He did his undergraduate study at Columbia and earned a PhD at Rockefeller. His current research and writings focus primarily on children's natural ways of learning and the lifelong value of play. So we're delighted to have you with us today, Dr. Gray. We do like to start these conversations asking our guests to go back to their own school days. And being an academic as you were, going through the whole system to get your PhD, and now a staunch advocate of self-directed child-led learning, I was wondering if you could look back on your days at school now and see how things may have been done differently and what flaws you found in the system.
Yes, that's a good question. I've done a lot of schooling, elementary, secondary, college, graduate school through a PhD. So I've been schooled a lot. I guess I always felt, and I don't think this is an uncommon feeling, like school doesn't really have much to do with my education. I'm not sure that everybody puts it in those terms, but I think most kids kind of understand that. It's something that you've got to go through. It's something that's just like a set of hoops that's set up for you. Fortunately, when I was a kid, school didn't take as much time as it does today. So the school day was about the same as it is today, but we had 5 extra weeks of vacation in the summer compared to today. We didn't have homework, certainly not in elementary school. And at least in the small schools, we moved around a lot, so I went to a lot of different schools. But in the small schools I attended, the teachers seemed to be pretty understanding of kids, and they would give us extra recess time. I know that in 5th and 6th grade, we had 6-hour school days, but we were outdoors 2 of those hours. We had half-hour recess in the morning, half-hour in the afternoon, a full hour at lunch. Sometimes she would just let us play in the classroom. So school was not quite the onerous thing back in the 1950s when I was an elementary student was today. But still, I think I understood, and I remember other kids saying, this is just something that we have to do. At some point, I decided I wanted to go into a career that required a college education. And I remember saying to my mom, I guess I was probably in about 8th grade or so, saying to my mom that I was thinking I want to go to college. And she said, we don't have any money for that. That was not something that was really expected in my family. So she said, I understand there are scholarships. If you get high grades, maybe you could go that way. So I decided at that point, I better get high grades. I didn't have any other reason for studying hard in school except to get high grades so I could get a scholarship and go on to college, because I believed college was crucial for the kind of career I was thinking of at that time. So I got high grades. I ended up getting a scholarship to Columbia University. And again, at Columbia, whereas a lot of Columbia graduates speak very fondly of the core curriculum and all of that, I thought it was it was sort of shallow and superficial. It was aimed more at teach at making us be able to appear intellectual and smart, because we knew the names of a lot of philosophers and great writers and so on, and knew just a little bit about them, but it really wasn't oriented towards thinking deeply and so on. And that was true for most of my courses there. And so once again, I think that my real education when I was in college was what occurred outside of school. I had to supplement my scholarship. I had various jobs working with kids. And I think that it was those jobs working with kids that I learned a lot more that informs what I'm doing today than anything that ever happened in the classroom.
Right.
When I decided I wanted to get a PhD, I went to the one graduate school that I could find, Rockefeller University, where you could get a PhD without taking any courses. So I was really fed up with courses by that point. And it's occurred to me since that graduate school was the first school that I was at. If you call it a school, it was really a research institution, the Rockefeller Institute for Biomedical Research. It was the first schooling I had, if you call it schooling, that was really self-directed. People weren't telling me what I had to do. I was getting advice when I wanted it. I was connecting with researchers that I wanted to connect with. And that was a very interesting experience. And so it's interesting to me to see that the first time I experienced something like what children experience in, say, a Sudbury school or an Agile Learning Center or another school that's set up for self-directed learning was when I was working for a PhD.
Right. Okay, a fascinating journey. So you really made your own path into your role as a research professor now through, as you say, just jumping through the necessary hoops. Yeah, that's very interesting to hear. And I know you do specialize. Many of our guests have mentioned your studies into the importance of play. So I just wonder if you could take us into how that came about, your sort of interest in that. How you say humans are actually biologically designed by natural selection to educate ourselves, and the importance of play, and how that's played a critical role in our evolution.
Yes, I think we really... social scientists have really ignored play, and it's probably certainly one of the most important categories of human activity that there is, and probably the most important category of human activity in terms of children's development. And all mammals play, at least all mammals that have been studied to any degree, play when they're young, and they play at the kinds of skills that they have to acquire in order to succeed in the environment in which they grow up and succeed as the kind of animal that they are. So predators play at predation. The prey animals like gazelles play at getting away from predators, dodging and fleeing and so on. You can pretty much predict what an animal will play at by knowing what they've got to learn in order to survive and thrive in the environment that they're growing up in. So it's not surprising we humans are mammals, and we have way more to learn than any other mammal does. And what we learn depends not only on our being human beings, what we have to learn, but also depends on the particular culture that we grow up in. So from an evolutionary perspective, it's not surprising that human children, when given the opportunity, play more, far more, and in far more different ways than the young of any other animal species. So one way that I've studied this is to look at children in hunter-gatherer cultures. Unfortunately, not directly. I haven't had the opportunity to directly observe hunter-gatherer cultures myself. But by way of surveying anthropologists who have lived in and observed hunter-gatherer cultures, what I have learned is that children in those cultures are, and by children, I mean from the age of 4 to sort of mid to late teenage years, are playing and exploring pretty much on their own all day long. Nobody expects any work from them or very little work from them. The understanding is that childhood is the time for play and exploring, and that that's the that's how children and adolescents acquire the whole range of skills that are necessary to be effective adults in the culture that they're growing up in. So it was interesting to me. I mean, anthropologist after anthropologist said that when I asked them how much time did the children have to play, they would say from dawn to dusk, or essentially all the time. So that was kind of an eye-opening experience for me. Even I did not expect that, as much as I already appreciated the value of play and appreciated the fact that children, when they have the opportunity, play in immensely different ways and in ways that leads them to learn sort of the whole range of things that people have to learn to be successful.
Right, that's fascinating. Yeah, and it's definitely something we don't see much of, in fact, very little of in the school model. Another thing that really fascinates me about your research and resonated with me is the idea of creativity and how that's being diminished, perhaps through the traditional school model, the coercive style of learning, and how that reflects on the more non-directive, non-judgmental parenting that plays such a critical role in the ability for a child to become creative. And the two studies you mentioned was the Torrance tests of creative thinking. And these give you an idea that there might be some sort of creativity crisis, one of the researchers mentioned. And I just wonder if you could take us through that a little bit, see how the endless testing that we see in the public schools is actually decreasing creativity.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody understands that creativity is not something that can be taught. It's not something that comes about by way of drill. Creativity almost by definition requires freedom, the freedom to think in your own ways, the freedom to look outside the box, the freedom to do things that other people maybe don't even understand what you're doing, including the teacher wouldn't understand what you're doing. So you can't teach creativity. You can't test for it in a classroom style way of testing, certainly not. You can't grade people on creativity. So, you know, when we got hooked on this idea that the purpose of school is to get high test scores and so that we outrank the people in Singapore or wherever it is that we're comparing on the PISA tests, you know, we began to constrict even much further than it already was constricted the curriculum in schools. You know, when I was a kid in school, as I said before, we had a lot of time just to play. We had a lot of recess time, lunch time to play and explore. But even in our classroom work, we would often be given sort of creative things to do that weren't rigorously graded. They were just kind of fun. Write a poem or write a story or draw pictures. we had those kinds of things. And but now those kinds of things have been more or less given up because teachers are judged on the basis of the test scores in academic subjects that the students in their classroom get. So teachers feel they can't afford the time to allow the kids to do creative things. So not surprisingly, over this same period of time, school has become more and more narrowly focused on so-called academic endeavors, and we've taken away play, we've decreased the amount of opportunity for children to have to play outside of school as well as in school. Not surprisingly, there has been a decline in creativity. Now, how do we know there's such a decline? At first, I was skeptical of this, but it turns out there actually is a rather valid way of assessing creativity. The Torrance tests for creative thinking, which were developed some decades ago, and been used in schools, given to normative groups of school of children from kindergarten on through grade 12 for many decades now. And there have been follow-up studies that show that those children who score very high on this test of creativity actually turn out to be far more creative in their adult life than those who score lower. So by that measure, it's a pretty good test, apparently quite valid. There better than it's a much better predictor than any other predictor we know of, including better predictor than IQ tests or grades in school or teachers' judgments of who's likely to do great creative things later on in life. So people who score high on this, they're likely more likely to start new businesses, invent new products, write novels, or even write nonfiction, all the kinds of things that call in that are within this large compass of endeavors that require a good deal of creativity, are much more likely to do than people who score lower. Now, a couple of years ago, a researcher whose last name is Kim did an analysis of the scores on Torrance's tests over the decades. And what she found is, beginning sort of in the mid-1980s, there was a continuous drop in the scores every year, essentially every year, from then until the time at which she did this study, which was probably about 2010 or 2012 or something like that. So isn't that interesting? And a rather large decline, at least on some of the sum components, a decline of as much as one standard deviation. One standard deviation, if we translate it into something that may make more sense to listeners, would mean that the person who scores average on that test today would be in about the 15th percentile back in 1984. In other words, 85% of people would have scored better than average today. So that's a big, big change. And this change is occurring at a time when really everybody understands creativity is more important today than it ever has been in the past, at least in the recent past. We no longer need people who to do non-creative things. We've got robots, we've got computers, we don't need people who can give us answers to questions that are already answered. You can just Google that. We don't need people to do routine work. We've got robots to do that. We've got all kinds of computers, and in the future, this is going to be even more true. What we need is people who can do things that machines can't do, who can ask questions and answer questions that haven't been asked before, who can think of those questions. We need people to do the kinds of non-routine things, and those are all involve creativity. So isn't it ironic that here we are believing, at least some people believe, that we are trying to reform education by adding more testing and more, quote, rigor to the academic training in order to enable our children to do well in the workforce, when in fact, by doing so, we are depriving them of the opportunity to develop what is probably the most important ability for them to develop for success in the workforce of day and tomorrow, which is creativity.
Yes, yeah, it definitely seems to be. There's two paths, and the idea of government schooling seems to be on the wrong track at the moment. We do ask our guests here to see if they see any change coming about in the public school system to a more self-directed learning environment that you advocate. And I know from your recent email, you do see this is a very important subject that you're going to put a lot of effort into, and consider it a civil rights issue, the idea of compulsory government coercive schooling. And I really resonate with the framing that in this light, and the urgency you put there. So I was just wondering, do you see schools being able to change, or are they best left to a natural decline?
Well, it's interesting. I've sort of got two ways to answer this. As you might know, I'm involved with two nonprofit organizations. One is the Alliance for Self-Directed Education. And when I've got that hat on, I am focusing on helping people get out of schools as we know them, not just government schools, but all schools that operate in what we call this kind of standard way, where children are really, the task of children is to do what they're told to do rather than to figure out what they really want to do and then find ways to pursue that. So self-directed education is that. Now, I don't think that
government schools or standard private schools are going to change in that direction. There's always been some movement back and forth, some liberalization of what happens in school. There's sort of a pendulum that goes back and forth. It's gone back and forth two or three times over the course of the history of compulsive schooling, where we have sort of a progressive movement, and then and there's a little bit more choice, and there's more creative activity in school, and then somebody gets interested in testing, and testing on traditional people begin to get interested in testing on traditional academic subjects, and they say, no, we need to spend more time and more directly teaching traditional academic subjects, and then the pendulum swings back. I don't think that schools as we generally know them, whether private or public, are going to become centers for self-directed education. I think that the way self-directed education is going to occur and is already beginning to occur is by more and more people leaving such schools. Leaving it for homeschooling, which then becomes unschooling. leaving it for those learning centers, which might be called schools, that are really designed for self-directed education, where children have the opportunity to discover their own interests and pursue those interests in their own ways, at their own time, and where they're not being tested and evaluated along the way. So that's what I'm involved with the Alliance. That's where much of my lies. On the other hand, let's recognize that right now the vast majority of children are in standard public and private schools. And many of them are suffering. More are suffering than even realize they're suffering. They're suffering in ways that may not show up right away. They're suffering in the kinds of ways I've described. They're not developing the creative skills that they need for success in life. Huge numbers of them are becoming anxious, depressed, even suicidal. The percentage of teenagers in high school who have suicidal imagery, imagine possibility of suicide largely as a result of the anxieties and depressions that they're feeling about what's happening in school, is huge and growing. So I think that we owe it to those people who are stuck in school to try to do what we can to make the school environment a better environment. And so I am, in fact, working with some school systems through a different organization called Let Grow, aimed at bringing more play into the schools and so on. So I think that for society to be involved in both of these endeavors. We need to try to remedy some of the harm that's being done in school, but we also, for the long range, need to be working on how do we get children into something that's very, very different from what we usually think of as school, where children are truly in charge of their education.
Right. Yes, that's a very balanced and thoughtful approach. Yes, we've had so many different takes on that same question. And I just want to thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Gray. I know you're hoping to get out skiing this afternoon, so we'll let you get on, and hopefully better speak to you again in the future about something like one of your more specific subjects. And I'll leave all the details for people to contact you. Is there a best way they can contact you?
We've got websites, and it would be great if people would like to join the Alliance for Self-Directed Education. There are forums there to share ideas, and so I would recommend that. I also have a Facebook page, and people can comment and contact me through the Facebook page. That's easy to find.
That's great. And I'll make sure I point everyone in the direction of your fascinating, easy to read and very understandable articles on all aspects of education. So thank you once again, Dr. Gray.
Thank you.
I hope you got as much out of that talk as I did. An excellent insight into the endless possibilities of how learning can look today. If you've been inspired by any of these great guests and would like us to reach more like-minded families looking for alternatives to school, please head over to iTunes, subscribe and leave us a positive review. And we'll see you real soon.
Earth is beckoning now, calling us with this new song. Yeah, you gotta listen what it has to say. It will guide you along. Yeah, you gotta put yourself first every time, and she will catch you when you fall. Yeah, you gotta love yourself from within. Love yourself till you're full. Yeah, yeah. You gotta take the power back.
Ask yourself this question: what is so amazing and wonderful at government-run schools that you would send your children there to be taught by essentially strangers, a curriculum over which you have no authority or control? How would you like to be a part of your children's learning? You were a part of your children's learning as colors, how she ties her shoes, what is a butterfly, why mommy loves her. Why would you not want to continue to be a part of that?
Look at what you've been told for so long. Maybe they're not right, and maybe your instincts are right. Unlearn those things.
This is about human rights and endowing children with dignity and agency and autonomy. And then guess what? As a side benefit, it works.
We come to see that learning isn't about doing well at school. It's about engaging with life.